Well, one individual that Steiner met and knew was willing to dive into this world of strife and to take it up in an active and we might say self-guiding way. And this was Emil Molt. Emil Molt, who had grown up in a family that was by no means well off, grew up in real need, had to find his way in the world. There's something of Charles Dickens in his life and the kind of hardships he faced again and again as a young man, and the working for people who really treated him terribly or who took advantage of him in terrible ways. But he remained a very optimistic individual, and his credo in his life was self-improvement. How can I work harder? How can I be a better worker? What do I need to do so that I can be my own boss and not have to follow the orders of others? And he came upon anthroposophy, and there he discovered a path, a kind of what pop psychology would say today, of self-improvement. So he did not come to meet the Christ being. He did not come because he was drawn to Steiner's pictures of Earth evolution. He did not come for a kind of mystical union with the higher world. He came because he felt that this will make me a better person, strengthen my individuality, and make me more sensible in the way I go about my life. Not the usual anthroposophical approach. And with this then, along with his immersion in anthroposophy, he actually did find he was more successful in his life and his business life. And finally then, he became the manager and essentially the CEO of the Waldorf Astoria cigarette factory. And it was in this context that he was to meet Rudolf Steiner personally. He had gone to Steiner's lectures, but hadn't made too much of a personal connection with him. But he asked Rudolf Steiner to come and give his workers the kinds of courses that he had given at the workers' school for the socialists years before. When Molt took over the management of the factory, he instituted a kind of health insurance program for his workers. He instituted areas where they could exercise. He changed their workday to make it less stressful. And he altogether raised their morale so that among his workers, there were few who were calling for unionization. There were few who were calling for revolution. They were happy with Emil Molt as their boss. And he wanted to continue that. But after the war, Germany's economy fell into a state of complete collapse. Inflation was such that you needed a wheelbarrow filled with Deutschmarks to be able to buy a loaf of bread. And the prices just became astronomical. The value of the money went down. So along with starvation, along with influenza, that I described earlier, there was now the fact that there was virtually no money. Supplies like tobacco, which mostly came from the Americas, were very infrequent. Even the paper used for the cigarettes, which was imported from other countries, that too came in spurts and then was not available. The cellophane for packaging the cigarette packs, all of this became very circumstantial, whether it would arrive or not. But Molt kept his workers employed, he kept paying them, and to counter their boredom, he started this school, these courses, and asked Rudolf Steiner to come. And the workers really loved Steiner. They wanted him the most. What would he speak to them about? The spiritual world, about finding their way to the Christ, about the Atlanteans and the migrations from Atlantis. He spoke to them about the history of tobacco. He described to them how the excitement of Europeans when they first saw the Native Americans passing around these pipes, and how contented they grew as they smoked, and how these pipes really did bring peace to the groups. And when the Europeans tried it after some coughing and irritated throats, they discovered that they really liked it as well. For example, Sir Walter Raleigh was the first man in England ever to receive such a peace pipe and smoke it, and he loved it. He showed his friends this pipe, and in fact, in one such showing, he smoked it at friends' castles and so on. Then he brought it home to his own castle, and he was sitting smoking it while some of his friends watched in wonder. And his servant was in another room, came in to bring everybody a little bit to eat, saw his master with smoke coming out of his mouth, grabbed a bucket full of water and poured it over his head. So I'm sure Steiner pointed out how as soon as tobacco was used, there were already anti-smoking campaigns that were brought. He probably told them that the tobacco trade became so active in the American South that the indentured servants were not a sufficient labor force to be able to cultivate and harvest all the tobacco. Harvesting tobacco and curing it is a very special process, and they couldn't take the heat. They were Europeans, and tobacco likes to grow where you have almost a subtropical to somewhat temperate climate. This was the reason that the first African slaves were brought to the United States. Not cotton, tobacco. And who brought them? No one other than the husband, a very wealthy planter in Virginia, the husband of Pocahontas. No, not Elizabeth Warren, the real Pocahontas. Her husband brought the first slaves to America after she died, so she had nothing to do with it. I'm not so sure she would have really liked that. But she died in England. He had come back from England and saw there the potential for what tobacco was going to become, and he tripled the size of his farm, but couldn't find the workers. So that's how slavery began in the United States, with tobacco. And then Steiner undoubtedly told the workers about the way tobacco is cured, the heat process, the drying process, just enough moisture not to be moldy, but to be able for the chemicals in the tobacco to come to a kind of curing. These sort of astral etheric forces that work together in tobacco in a very, very refined way so that the nicotine remains lively and can the alkaloids, the poisons, are cultivated and cared for, not for medical purposes, but for the purposes essentially of people getting habituated to them, addicted to them. He spoke about the history of paper, where this fine, fine paper came from that was to lead, because cigars, of course, were wrapped in tobacco, a tobacco leaf. Cigarettes need paper. Cigarettes needed the machinery developed in the late 1800s that could roll cigarettes 30 times faster than the fastest people could do by hand. That made cigarettes an industrial commodity. That led to the factory. However, the more popular cigarettes became, the more doctors became alarmed. Because who was smoking in the 1880s and 1890s? Everybody. Men, women, children. There were reporters described 8 and 9-year-old children sitting contentedly, smoking pipes, later on cigarettes with their parents. It kept them calm, the mother would say. They always loved it. It was the big treat of the day for their children to smoke. So we Waldorf teachers think our kids are really in a bad way today. I don't know if Steiner described that, but now that cigarettes could be produced and more people were smoking, some doctors were saying there's a relationship, 1880s and 90s, a relationship between cancer and smoking. Benjamin Rush, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, one of the leading American revolutionaries, a great doctor of his time, he already was speaking about respiratory damage done by tobacco. So what happened was in the late 19th century, states began to outlaw cigarettes and outlaw cigars and outlaw the consumption of tobacco. There were very strict laws throughout the United States and then in Europe as well. And actually the production of cigarettes and the whole tobacco industry took a huge dip in the early 1900s, in the first decade. They just kind of went along. Okay, now we come to 1919, and Emil Moldt says, look, have these workers, I'm paying them anyway, even though they're not doing anything. They have, you see that, like that medical clinic they have, and I mean, look at the photograph of these people. They don't look like they come from Charles Dickens. They're not exactly wearing rags and so on. The women are extremely fashionably dressed. They look a bit like early flappers. And the men are wearing very nice suits. Okay, it's their Sunday best. It's for a photograph. But these people clearly are not starving Germans. They don't look like they're suffering from the flu or anything. They look pretty well off. And then Moldt says, there's this tavern in Stuttgart. We could buy that. Don't worry, I'll buy it and I'll fix the whole thing up. We'll turn it into a school. Where does the money come from? Tobacco's illegal, right? Tobacco is, it's a losing proposition. Yeah, until the Great War. Because what some very observant officers noticed was that when cigarettes were smuggled into the front, they were illegal, and their soldiers would smoke in the trenches, they calmed down. They were less nervous. They were less edgy. They were more courageous. They were more awake. It was funny. They were less nervous. They were more awake. As long as they got their regular daily dose of smoking, it really helped them. Word spread very quickly in the German high command, we need cigarettes. And when the Americans finally came over in 1917, the general leading the American troops said, the two most important things for our men, guns and cigarettes. So the governments, all the European governments, subsidized their tobacco companies and bought tremendous quantities of cigarette packs. And what did the companies do? They kept raising the price. This is great, We just, they'll pay anything. The soldiers need it more and more and more. Wow, they can't stop smoking. This is fantastic. And at least Emil Moldt, he saw opportunity knocking always, and he created these little cards with passages from his dear friend Hermann Hesse, Rainer Maria Rilke, and Rudolf Steiner that went into the cigarette packs. They were packed in the cellophane. You could go into the archives in Dornach and see these packages. Waldorf Astoria cigarettes, and there are these little with sayings from Steiner, mostly from Theosophy. And it was said that soldiers would be found killed, dead, their fist was clasped around something, and it was one of Steiner's passages, the last thing perhaps they had been reading in these cigarette packs. So, you know, there in a way you make a virtue of a necessity. But this is why the Waldorf Astoria cigarette factory had literally money to burn. Why? Because soldiers were addicted to cigarettes. They came home and they got their wives smoking, and their children saw everybody enjoying themselves and were right back in the 1870s and 1880s of the more the merrier. Everybody, all ages, smoking, and governments do not dare to set up any kind of regulations or laws because these are the veterans. And if they don't get what they need, this to which they're addicted, they're gonna, you know, who knows what they're gonna do. So it's like the opioid crisis of that time. And Emil Molt was like the Sackler family of his time. Now, I'm not saying this just to kind of make light of it. Have you ever heard this before? Has anybody ever said, it's interesting, a cigarette factory, and they had so much money and everything. Emil Molt run a cigarette factory. And he was such a, you know, I mean, he was a fantastic individual, you know, clearly kind of another, a former initiate living there and working with Steiner. But we have to recognize this fact that lives at the basis of the possibility of forming the Waldorf School. Steiner could not have done this himself. The membership was pretty much nearly impoverished. Steiner wanted to start the first Waldorf School. It wouldn't have had that name. He wanted to start a school between 1905 and 1907. He gave the same lecture again and again, The Education of the Child in the Light of Anthroposophy, to whoever would listen to it. He gave it in a coffee house in Prague, to which somebody took me to see there. And again, you can imagine everybody talking and whatever, nobody listening to him. Unfortunately, most of his membership in that time was either unmarried or childless. That's just the way it was for his members. They were members of the aristocracy, however. There were members of the industrial class. There were people with a lot of money. And Steiner felt we could start a school with their money. And right now, it's a time of peace. You know, the whole climate of society, there's a tremendous interest in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, in culture, in cultivating the human being, in helping the workers. Perfect, perfect, perfect. What a time to start a school right now. But nobody asked him. Nobody was interested. You know, people would come to him, I have a question about my child. Steiner would say, yes, you want to know if I could start a school? Because as an initiate, he has to wait till somebody asks the question to give the answer. Unlike the rest of us who lecture on anthroposophy and give all kinds of answers to no questions at all. So, yes, what is it? Should I name my girl Sophia or Maria? Now, you say Sophia in anthroposophy, you know, oh my gosh, another one of these. Yes, call her Sally. Anyway, you know, what color should my child's room be? And, you know, all this sort of thing. My child won't eat millet. What should I do? We'll start a school where they have to eat millet. That's what we'll do. Couldn't get that question. So it waited and waited, but there it was living, which is why when Emil Molt asked him in January of 1919, Molt said, I'd like to start a school for my workers' children because I think it's too late for the workers. Your lectures are wonderful, they're helpful, they're great, but they're tired. They already are set in their ways, but maybe their children, maybe. And Steiner said, well, let's talk more about it. And Molt said, I don't want it to look like I'm starting it myself, because everything else I start myself, and maybe they'll resent that finally. But if you started it, That might be very helpful. Well, they were interrupted almost immediately, and things went on, and Steiner had meetings to go to, and on and on and on it went. And it wasn't then until April that he and Malt really sat down and had the conversation that was like the, you know, conceiving of the school, where it could really be born and something that would really happen. And I just want to go back again to the money that came from tobacco. That made the school possible for several years. Finally, even Malt's business could not go forward. But that had little to do with the value of tobacco and much more to do with all the help he was trying to give many anthroposophical endeavors. Finally, in the end, what he and Steiner could salvage from what was called the Kommender Tag, the coming day, a holding company that they formed for anthroposophical endeavors. The only things that could finally come out of it were the Waldorf School and Wolita. And Emil Malt was really the founder of Wolita as well. And I had the great privilege of knowing his youngest son, Walter, who brought Wolita to the United States. And many of you, or at least a number of you, know his granddaughter, Sophia Malt Murphy, who founded Lily Poe magazine, now lives in Ireland with her husband, Finbar Murphy. Grace Ann and I go back with her a long time. So anyway, that family remains still active in one way or another. Okay. Waldorf education needed three things to get going. One, Rudolf Steiner. Number two, money. Number three, addiction. Or Rudolf Steiner wouldn't have been able to do it, and the money wouldn't have been there. Is that still true of Waldorf education? Well, you're all East Coast people. If you were living in the West Coast, you'd all be shaking your heads like this immediately, because you'd know that the major donors to all of the Waldorf charter schools, the public Waldorf schools, which still need a whole lot of money in California, are the Vineyards. Why are the Vineyards giving money to the Waldorf schools? Because they're all biodynamic vineyards, and they see the value of Rudolf Steiner. They can't get anybody who knows about growing grapes biodynamically from the United States, so they invite somebody from Germany or France who says immediately, I'm happy to come. Where's the closest Waldorf school for my children? What's a Waldorf school? Okay, you start a Waldorf school and I'll come. And it's almost been like that. The charters and the vineyards, they're very close to each other. Now, I'm not saying people are addicted to wine, although you watch any movie or anything like that and you'd say, hey, people are really addicted to wine. But it's a very big deal in our country. Wine has really experienced a renaissance, and in Europe, and biodynamic wine is just, it's on the cover of all of the wine magazines. And when I go to a restaurant in New York, I don't drink myself, but I always say, can I see your wine list? And there'll always be 2, 3, 4, 5 biodynamic wines. And they're the most expensive wines on the list. And they don't have to explain to anybody who likes wine why that is. They just will order it. So yeah, we need another kind of addiction. And I can assure you that within a few years, as marijuana gets more legalized in California in particular, there already are biodynamic methods being applied to marijuana growth in California that I know of. And of course, for medicinal purposes only and so on. But there again, that will also be a source of funding for Waldorf schools. It actually has been a source of funding for a number of Waldorf schools in the West and in Hawaii for a number of years, but they can't talk about it. But it's been a huge, made a lot of schools' existence possible. So there we have it in a certain way. It's like we can't quite get off the hook. pure though we may be, as pure as the driven snow in a certain way, and no screens and no TV, no writing on your shirt. I don't care about that vineyard, no writing on your shirt. All of that, underlying it, there still is this question of where is our money going to come from? Not armaments, very likely, and you know, not human trafficking or something like that. But even we have to eat that peck of dirt in a certain respect. And I think it's important, you know, to see the big picture of that Waldorf Astoria cigarette factory. Fortunately, the school was not totally dependent on it for very long. It was there at the midwife stage. But like the Theosophical School, that tobacco money was needed there for a period of time. So here are some words from Emil Malt. The original idea which led to the founding of the school was a social one, to provide for the children of workmen and employees the same teaching and education enjoyed by children of families with means. The insight was involved that the social chasm might begin to close if the problem of education were no longer dependent upon money. That's Malt's real interest, that our cultural, economic, and political advancement would be possible only if all children, without distinction of the class to which their parents belonged, were permitted to share in the same educational system. Maria Montessori never said that, nor did A.S. Neal, and certainly not John Dewey, who spoke about democracy, but nobody spoke about the classes, the division of classes, which of course in Europe was still strong, however, had been thrown asunder by the war, where the old aristocracy suddenly found itself kind of unemployed. So this was the moment where one could really bring about something democratic and classless. And let me just read that first sentence again, because it's easy to miss what he's saying here. It was a social one, the original impulse. He doesn't say pedagogical, he doesn't say spiritual. His question to Steiner was, could you form a school that would lead to world peace and social justice? This is what Malt asked Steiner, and Steiner immediately said, yes. It was not at first about the curriculum or about whether boys and girls should knit together and so on. It was a social question. And that, I think, is so important for us to remember. To provide for children of workmen and employees the same teaching and education enjoyed by children of families with means. Well, what does this signify? Children of family with means had 16 years of education. They started in first grade. They went on to gymnasium in the equivalent of grade 8 or 9. They had that education until grade 12 or 13. And then they had 4, even 6 more years of university education. That all cost money, or it meant connections of one kind, or it meant, you know, bloodline that just got you in there automatically. The children in the Waldorf school, the children of employees, of factory workers, they were given 8 years of education. Steiner wanted the school to go from grade 1 through 7. There was no kindergarten at that point, and no grade 8. The state of Schwäbisch Gmünd said, no, you can't establish the school with 7 grades, you need 8 grades, because after that, the children go into their apprenticeship. These are workers' children, this is where they go. No gymnasium, maybe for the very brightest ones, Realschule, which is like a vocational school. No university whatsoever. Yet here Malt is saying, The same teaching and education enjoyed by children of family with means. What this means is that in 8 years, I as a class teacher should be giving children the equivalent of 16 years of education, that they shouldn't even need high school, certainly not university. This is what the Waldorf curriculum, this is what Steiner designed. If you read what he said, yes, so then the children, the German children, will read in English A Christmas Carol. Give them a couple of nights for that in Charles Dickens' English. You try to get an American kid to read that and understand a word of it today. And then, of course, they'll be doing the quadratic equations. And I think a little calculus might be, you know, you read this, my God, no, what universe is he coming from? So this is what he wanted, that Waldorf schools were not just dreamy, slow, you know, you learn at your own pace. That's A.S. Neal. That's not Steiner. A lot of stuff from American culture, especially the 1960s, which some of us actually lived through and lived after, that's gotten so mixed up with Waldorf in America, and that then has kind of spread virally in a certain way to the rest of Waldorf in the world. No, Steiner wanted the first 3 years, yes, to be, I want to learn to read. No, darling, not yet. I want to do calculus. Not yet, sweetheart, come back. That the children develop this kind of coiled spring quality. I want to go forward. No, hold back. And then, go ahead. They take a broad jump. That's what the Waldorf curriculum is. 6, 7, and 8, you're moving at the speed of light. It becomes extremely demanding, extremely rigorous, and the children really should have the equivalent of a college education, in fact, better than what most American colleges offer. They know who Charlemagne was. They know why Luther felt he had to start the Reformation. They understand the scientific basis of the scientific revolution and the social ramifications it had. All of this, a class teacher should be giving this to the children so that they are really getting an education of 16 years squeezed into 8. It's very compressed. It's very dense because this is how the spiritual world works. With spiritual economy. And we're not really, on the whole today, being economical enough. We're not taking this seriously. Not that they should feel good about themselves after 8 grades. Steiner basically says to us, you can't feel good about yourself today at all. If you do, there's something wrong with you. Rather, that they should feel ready to meet the world and know the world, and not necessarily to know every fact about the way Brunelleschi developed his wonderful dome in Florence in the Renaissance, which they learn in grade 7, but to have an appreciation of it, which is no less deep, no less meaningful than that of a college student. Steiner wanted the workers to be able to sit in a concert hall to watch a Wagner opera, to listen to a Bach chorale, and have the same degree of inner appreciation, and to feel, I own this too. This is part of my legacy. This isn't just high class stuff. And we see today how the 1%, the 0.1%, the 0.01%, how in a certain way they are aggrandizing, pulling the cultural life away for themselves. Unless you've got $500 for a ticket to Wagner's opera at the Met right now, unless you've got $1,500 to watch a Broadway play and have halfway decent seats and so on, or to go to the Met Gala or whatever it is, you're not welcome in the artistic world. Now, of course, that's extreme, but this is really where it's leading, where it's going. And the impulse of Waldorf education was to level that playing ground, Not to say all people are the same and all people should be working the same way. It wasn't communism. It was true humanism. It was allowing people to find the human being and realizing education is the way to do this. I'll read one more paragraph of Emil Malt and then I will break for, we'll have half an hour or so of questions. Looking back, just a moment, let me go back, that it became known that Dr. Steiner had accepted the leadership of the school. The children of certain friends and acquaintances were added to the factory children. Steiner's wish was factory children. Never happened. The majority in the first year were factory children, but unfortunately, a whole bunch of anthroposophists wanted their children to go there as well. And he had to leave them free. He couldn't, you know, tell them no, not allowed. And within about 5 years, factory children were in the minority in the school. And things changed. Steiner did not live to see that final step, but from that moment on, Waldorf became more and more the province of the upper middle class, bourgeoisie, and the rich. So September 7th, 1919, I'll be talking about that next week when I look at autumn, or summer rather. There could be a festive opening of the school with 200 children and about 15 teachers. The first school that will open its doors as a new school in the second 100 years will open its doors in Provo, Utah. It will have a parent body that is mostly Mormon and a faculty that is mostly Mormon. It will open its doors with, the way it looks right now, somewhere between 300 to 500 children, and probably a faculty of about 50. It's a charter school, public. So that's what the second 100 years are going to look like. No factories around. It'll be a lot of people from Brigham Young University sending their children there. A whole new degree of challenge for Waldorf education. The largest Waldorf school in the United States, which is already in existence, has 550 children and a waiting list of 1,600 children. It's in Salt Lake City, Utah. It's also strong Mormon influence there. Looking back, one can well say that it was a great experiment. We heard what Steiner had to say about experiments before. To bring together children out of all schools, from the lowest grades in the elementary school, from the secondary schools, the technical schools, the technical gymnasiums and gymnasiums, boys and girls of all religious creeds. Nothing like that in all of Europe. From the very beginning, all of these came together in the Waldorf school, children out of every stratum of the population. The teachers had to be drawn together from various regions, and then prepared in advance by Dr. Steiner. We'll hear about that next week. There was no building available, no organization, no school bank, no book. There was available only a decidedly modest amount of money for the beginning. That's the words out of a tobacco CEO's mouth. The school had to come into existence out of absolutely nothing. But its actual assets, there were present the firm determination to help in the ascent of humanity and the inestimable good fortune to have won Rudolf Steiner as founder of a new pedagogy based upon his spiritual scientific knowledge. So there they went, into the bar and grill of Stuttgart to start their new school with tobacco money. Fantastic picture. And to transform it, start transforming it right away. Okay, so next week we'll hear more about, as Werner Glass once said to me, the best time to raise money for a Waldorf school is before it's opened its doors because it hasn't made any mistakes yet. We'll hear what happens once you open the doors of this very grand and wonderful experiment. And we'll also just be learning more about some of the poets and writers and artists active at that time, living in the soul spiritual life of Europe around that school as it opened its doors. So let's stop. Oh, thank you. Okay, questions, comments? We'll go until about 1 o'clock. Yes,
what are the
Elsa.
Ideas beyond the cigarette money?
Could you say that again?
What are the ideas for financing the world of school?
Oh, beyond the cigarette money.
Yes,
well, Steiner, in a way, accepted that money because his idea was that, again, if society could start at least moving towards a threefolding, that the profit, the surplus of industries and corporations would go to serving the cultural spiritual life. It would not just end up in the stockholders' pockets, but rather would go towards the financing of cultural centers and schools and a whole range of things. And this in Europe still does happen, that there are, Walita, for example, gave a very generous proportion of its profits to support Waldorf education for years and years. I think Siemens, one of the largest industrial corporations in Europe and the world, I believe they too help. And Staedtler, who make these wonderful drawing instruments, rulers and compasses and pencils, I think they are also funders of Waldorf education. So definitely that would really help a lot. A number of years ago, I was part of a group at Green Meadow Waldorf School that planned for months a German day in which we showed all of the things that the children learn in their German classes, and we invited representatives of the many German companies that have their headquarters right across the New Jersey border and send their children to Green Meadow Waldorf School because they send them to Waldorf schools in Germany, and they were happy to have the same. And we asked them to invite, if possible, their CEOs and other higher-ups to see if we could receive gifts from them. Even the general counsel of the German, the consulate in New York, agreed to appear, and he gave a wonderful speech, and he gave a $1,000 check, actually, to me. He said, you wrote the wrong name on it. It's Eugene Schwartz, not Green Meadow. Nothing came, and we went back. We had meetings with some of these people, and what did they say? Look, if I give $100,000 to Carnegie Hall or Lincoln Center, my name goes on a plaque. There you see, Mercedes-Benz, that was the guy I spoke to. You know, Mercedes-Benz, generous benefactor of this new extension of Lincoln Center. I can bring my clients there. I can bring my managers there, and they feel very proud. I give you guys $100,000. I don't know, do you even put plaques up? Don't you have some policy against that or something? But even if you do, what am I going to do? Oh, look, the first grade play couldn't happen without Mercedes donations. Sorry, the prestige just isn't there. And this is basically the message we got again and again. So it's tricky today. You know, corporations give tremendous amounts to cultural endeavors, but it's certain endeavors and certain fundraisers, and you know, it's still all about that the upper class in a certain way, having the right for that. And the other help, which is what the charter schools are doing, is to say we've got to accept government money, and if we're going to grow and if we're going to serve all children, including the classes that Molt spoke about, there's no way of doing that in the United States without government money, and certainly in Europe, there's even more generous government funding of many private schools. So that one still eludes us. And as I said, it's something of that peck of dirt that is almost unavoidable in our time. The question is, what do we do with that money that Lincoln Center might not be doing with that money? What's unique? What can we bring to the world that will even help to raise that money up a little bit to something more constructive? But I would have to share with you that after the first Gertianum burned, and there was, of course, insurance money coming to it, that's one of the things that Steiner said to the architects helping him was, this new building will not be built of wood. It will be built of concrete. And people say, yeah, of course, fireproof. That's smart thinking. But he said the reason is the first building was built out of love. It was the love of the members who came to Europe and sacrificed so much to be here and carve and do whatever they were asked to do. The second building will be built with insurance money, and they will hate it, and they will fight us for every penny. It will not be built out of love, which is living. It will be built out of animosity, which is dead. We must make it out of dead material. So that's one thing he said. Another thing he said, someone came upon him, had a meeting with him, and when they came in, there was Steiner looking despondent, which was rare, especially because he was holding a check in his hand, and he looked so upset. He said, what's the matter? And Steiner held up a check for a kingly sum. He said, I know for a fact that this money came to this man because of successful speculation on the stock market. It was manipulation of funds. There is nothing that I can do with this money. I have to give it back to him. So things can even go that far. Yeah. So it's still a very, a really big question. But my feeling is, it's the more deeply we can bring anthroposophy to Waldorf education, the more we will become creative in what we do with those funds. Not just to have pretty pictures and you know, nice looking classrooms, but it's also trying to find things to do to really solve social issues. And there, sad to say, the charter schools are far ahead of the free public charter schools, are far ahead of private schools. And I speak as a person who's visited 25 or more of such schools. They have huge issues. They make huge mistakes. But they bring in children who would never see the inside of a Waldorf classroom, and whose parents, I can't speak of what their gratitude is like. They'll do anything for that school. Okay. Yes. Sure. Okay. Comment on a book called Winners and Losers, which is questioning philanthropy. I don't know that book, but I guess from the title and the fact that it's about philanthropy, would say it's against philanthropy, that you're not helping people by giving them handouts in a certain way.
In fact, you are helping the philanthropist and his pursuits.
Yeah. Well, again, philanthropy has gone through some metamorphoses in the 21st century. And certainly, philanthropists have become more and more entrepreneurial in their work. You know, I only want to give money to something that's going to succeed and that's going to really make a difference. And what they mean by making a difference usually means that this will teach kids to code on their computers or something like that. Here's another story, which I have been told occurred also in 1919. I was going to save it for next week, but I'll bring it now. Rudolf Steiner and another one of his closest students were walking along on a street in Berlin. War is over, starvation and so on, and they come upon a man in the street, a wino, you know, obviously somebody who drinks a lot, holding out his hand. And of course, the student just, you know, walks on, as you learn to do when you live in a city. And he says, "So Dr. Steiner, he's putting money in the man's hand." And he knows Steiner doesn't carry much money along with him. He's giving it to him. So Steiner says, "One moment." He catches up with him. And the man says, this is Günter Vocksmith, by the way. Very thoughtful, very brilliant, the man who made the second Goetheanum really happen. He said, "Dr. Steiner, why are you doing that? The only thing he's going to do is drink. He's going to buy more to drink." And Steiner said, "Yes, I know. So why are you giving him the money?" Because Steiner said, "I can't do anything else for him." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "That kind of condition, we anthroposophists cannot help. We can't do anything." "Well, who can?" "The Salvation Army." He said, "They can help." By which I believe he means that, well, we have our limits, and, you know, that philanthropy, in some cases, does have to be, one might say, pearls before swine, or whatever this individual would say in a more modern, more politically correct way, that, yeah, a lot of money does in a certain sense get thrown away, and yet that money nonetheless is moving. It's moving through society, and Steiner's biggest concern wasn't always how you spend the money, but that you spend it. That he said, it's like a stream that's flowing. It's like blood flowing through the human being. The blood must move or we die. And another important book on the economy written a few years ago that got a tremendous amount of good write-ups in press, especially from the liberal world, is a book called Capital by a French economist, Piketty, in which he argues that what's different about wealth today than wealth in much of the 20th century is it's all about capital and very little about liquidity. That it's mostly about people just putting their money in a bank and collecting interest. And he shows how most of the top 10%, 1%, 0.1% are people who have great storehouses of money, that they're not rich because they're working so hard and they're creative. And there certainly are those who do, but they also immediately then try to turn it into capital. And capital, Steiner said, is the most spiritual aspect of the economy because you have the freedom and the power to bring that capital into a new kind of flow. Not to hold on to it, not to be the dragon guarding the hoard. You're welcome. Yes?
Are you aware of what Steiner or Mould would say, or how they started to compensate teachers or worker rights as far as the teachers in the beginning of older schools?
I will talk about that next week, but there again, this was not a thoroughly worked out measure because the money was coming from the factory. They were essentially Emil Moldt's employees, and Emil Moldt was the administrator of that school, and Steiner was furious when teachers would make sometimes even fairly small decisions without passing it by Herr Moldt. He wasn't happy about that. There again, a lot of what was there under Steiner and Moldt passed through the sieve of the 1960s in America and became antipathy to money, antipathy to administration, antipathy to structure, and became more like Summerhill and less like the true Waldorf school. That's changed just out of necessity because those schools could barely go forward. Now, in a certain way, the pendulum swung in the other direction, and it's starting to look, you know, a bit too much like a corporate model. But at least there's a striving for some kind of balance. So we'll talk more about the teachers in the school and Rudolf Steiner's interesting meetings with those teachers and what he had to say to them and what they had to ask of him. It's very interesting and sometimes even fun. Unlike modern teachers' meetings. Yes, dear John.
I just read yesterday something that maybe other people have known forever, but over 100 years earlier than Emma Moult, William Penn was setting up schools for all children in Philadelphia.
I was not.
I was
not aware of that. No. Yeah.
There's late 1600s, early 1700s.
Yeah. There's also the great New England educator whose daughter wrote Little Women, Bronson Alcott. He started a school like that as well in Boston, which was tolerated by his, you know, relatively liberal New Englanders until he brought the first black child in. And then that school was quickly shut down. So yeah, it's there, you know, just like Steiner's hope to start the school about 15 years earlier than he was able to. Somehow the time has to be just right and conditions dire enough that people are willing to be open to something new like that. Michael?
You posited a possible relationship between John Dewey and Richard and Rudolf Steiner earlier in terms of lecturing, possibly lecturing. He said that Steiner would have been welcomed.
Yes.
I got my head scratching a little bit about that. And you characterized Dewey in terms of his atheism, his humanism, and I think you touched upon pragmatism. In terms of humanism, I can see a real overlap there. Not so much with the atheism and not so much with the pragmatism. Do you want to say anything?
Yeah. Well, I think the tolerance and the openness, and that the new school, because among, for example, the people in that university in exile, there were some very left-leaning individuals. There were some individuals who have really become like the fathers of a lot of more right-leaning philosophy in our time. So I think out of tolerance and out of an interest in bringing European culture and European influences to the United States, I think Dewey would have said yes to it. And also, Dewey, one must remember, was considered to his students at Columbia University the most soporific influence they could imagine. That he was a horrible lecturer, a terrible teacher, but he did great research. And his writing was lively, very good, but he could never get that into his speech. It was very, very flat, very dull, and he didn't seem to like speaking publicly at all. Okay, all right, well, I think that, is there one more? Just one more question, yes? Yes.
And how there's a natural need for a breakdown and a reorganizing, a transformation.
Yes.
And I believe we just celebrated our 75th year. And about 5 years ago when I started working there was one of the many breakdowns. And I believe in our school's horoscope there's another one coming in 2020. Something significant. And so I'm wondering a little about if you have thoughts on what this reorganizing looks like to embrace that, or does the school just need to go under, or?
No, I don't think it needs to go under, but I think, well, I've gotten calls from parents in your school over this period of time, again and again asking me, is it possible to turn our school into a charter school so that we can get beyond the kind of elitism there? And I've said, it's a very, very distant possibility. Districts don't like doing that because they feel, well, look, you're failing. You know, we're not going to create a new school out of a failing foundation. Number one, that. And number two, the paperwork is so immense. It takes a certain kind of group of people, most of whom are not initially Waldorf teachers, to be able to deal with that kind of paperwork. Circle of Seasons, you could fill one of the rooms in your old school with what it took them to do it, and they were rejected once anyway and had to start all over again. But certainly helping a charter school get established is one possibility, but the fear is everybody's going to pull their children out of our school. It'll really hurt us. So you imagine a way of downsizing your school or perhaps making it two schools so that this could work. The other reality is in California, where it's possible in a one-hour radius to find two charters and one private school, they're all thriving. They're all doing well. Because it's very good for a faculty member of a Waldorf school not to send his or her children to that school. It's much better for them to be in another Waldorf school so that your own children are not getting the advantage of the work you're doing. It's a little, there's a selfish quality involved for many of us Waldorf practitioners of, well, this is the way to get my child in the school for free or a low tuition. And that shouldn't be. It should be that they go to a school where there are different teachers, where you're not involved with the background information and knowing what's wrong with every one of those teachers and so on. That would be healthy. It's not good for Waldorf schools to be monopolies. That is something that, you know, is very much against the grain of the threefold social order, where economics is associative, not controlling. But thus far, because of the costs, because they're private schools, it's been the only way to have a school. But that's starting to change. You know the rule, you have one gas station at an intersection, it makes $100,000 profit a year. You have four gas stations at the intersection, each one of them makes $200,000 a year. That's how schools are too. Okay, Gray, one last question. No, I don't. It's one of these, you know, statements by Steiner that people kind of don't put into the canon of things Steiner said. You know, I could tell you a lot more about what he said about the color black in first grade, let's say, which is, of course, you know, of cosmic proportions, than that he said, an institution basically should end after 70 years. What about the Anthroposophical Society itself? He didn't get that specific. We should stop at it, but I'm going for lunch. Okay. So, thank you.